time it looked like it had calmed down, a new gale rode in and dumped buckets of rain everywhere. Blaze spent the idle time trying to get Vanetha to expand. He'd been fooling around with it a little every day, but between all the swimming, fishing, and bathing, not to mention the exhausted sleep those things produced in massive volume, he'd had little time. It was good to get more practice in, but he could feel his time on Koos slipping away. Deep down, he'd been hoping to find a shell in the first few days, then take a hike up the volcano. He didn't think he'd ever climbed a volcano before. At last, the skies cleared. The rain dried. The seas were still choppy and visibility was less than ideal, but they had just 3 days remaining before Ro returned to take them back to the cove. Sand and pulverized plants wheeled through the waters, tugged this way and that by the angry tides. Many of the fish had gone into hiding, or maybe they'd been sucked away by the storm. Either way, the grinders were nowhere to be seen. The first day was a bust. On the second day, a follow-up storm blew in and ruined their chances. Blaze wandered along the beach, hoping to see a fresh shell turned up by the riotous waves. The storm raced off by late afternoon, and he was able to get back in the water for a couple hours. But the seas were so rough he didn't dare swim more than 100 feet from shore. The last day began well. Within minutes of diving in, he turned up another white-shelled juvenile. But the auspicious start just gave Blaze's hopes farther to fall. The sun peaked, then began its slow-motion crash into the sea. Over the course of their 2 weeks, they'd been venturing more and more to the south, leaving behind the rocky arm of the bay. As the afternoon waned, Blaze decided to reverse course and head straight north. It was too rough, the water too cloudy. Anyway, by sticking near the shore, they'd have better sight of the bottom. They hadn't been over the more sheltered water since arriving on Koo. The storms may have blown in a wandering Kelevert during their absence. Just as the sun hovered over the horizon, he saw a flash of yellow. Underwater, he beckoned to Min, but she gestured up and surfaced.
"Time to head in, I think," she said. "I just saw a grinder. In minutes it'll be too dark to see. We can try to squeeze in a couple hours in the morning."
He stuck his face under the surface and glimpsed the grinder drifting away to the north.
"Then I'll see you at the house."
He crawled after the fish, slowing down when he grew near so he wouldn't spook it. He glanced back and saw that Min had decided to follow him after all. He suddenly felt stupid. The water was already growing dark. If something came for them, they might not be able to see it until it was upon them. More plausibly, if they misjudged how far they were from an upthrust coral, a surge could drag them over it, shredding their skin, or even breaking their bones. 20 feet ahead, the grinder swashed its tail and dived straight down. Heart thudding, Blaze followed. Most likely it was after another crab, or biting senselessly at a branch of coral. But it went straight for a stretch of basalt, and began attacking the rock. A fist-sized lump of darkness slid away from the basalt, retracting its charcoal tail whenever the grinder darted in for another bite. Chapter 19. Dante stared down the team of soldiers. At times like these, confronted by common-issue warriors with sharp but ultimately mundane weapons, he was always tempted to destroy them, bring down the nether and churn them into a fine red mist. Even without having any of his blood at hand to feed the nether, he could do it almost effortlessly. But acts of incredible violence weren't as simple as that. For one thing, his friends were up there on the next flat. 3 nethermancers would make a potent group, but if Dante mystified 8 soldiers, the rest would be unleashed upon them post-haste.
the second encounter would be much nastier than the first. For another thing, he wasn't sure these men meant him harm. The only way to find out would be to go with them.
"The minister," Dante said mildly in the local tongue, aware his accent was less than stellar. "Are we arrested?" This seemed to confuse the lead soldier.
"The minister wishes to see you, so you will see him."
Ast glanced between Dante and the soldier. The tall man hid it well, but Dante had spent enough time around Blaze to look for the subtle tension in Ast's arms. He could draw his sword in a flash if he had to. Dante nodded once and stepped forward.
"We go."
The soldier eyed Dante's sheathed sword, then gestured them to head back to the staircase. Though Dante was dying to see if the others were seeing this, he was careful not to look up into the branches. Two of the soldiers took the lead up the stairs, with Dante and Ast in the middle, ushered upwards by the remaining six. It was a long walk, and Dante had questions, but he didn't trust his Wesleyan vocabulary. Lanterns flickered in the branches, pooling light over flats popular enough to be doing business after midnight. Dante wondered where they got their oil. Most of Narashtovic's was garnered from the whaling trade that thrived in the northern seas. If he'd had to bet, he'd bet money, Gascon silver or spirous teeth, that they piped their oil right out of the Lorens. They stopped at the toll gate to the fifth loft. The soldiers called to the guards. His speech was quick and informal. The guards were expecting them. They lowered the steps into place, and the soldiers continued their climb. It was too dark to tell, but the fifth and sixth lofts looked little different from the fourth. Halfway up the sixth, the soldiers stepped off the staircase and walked across a never-ending flat lined on both edges by plain row housing. Eventually, they reached another trunk-based staircase. They had crossed seamlessly from one Loren to another. Foreigner he might be, but Dante could tell at a glance this tree was different. The rounds on the other trunk had been individual, one-room apartments, but on this Loren, each round circled all the way around the trunk, giving the owner 360-degree views of the forest and a heck of a lot more living space. Alternately, he supposed they could be barracks for soldiers. Whatever the case, this tree was somehow associated with the court. After a whole bunch more stairs, with lanterns shining through 300 feet of branches below them, they reached an elaborate triple gate. While no tolls were required, one section of stairs couldn't be lowered until the next one had been raised. The metal teeth of cranks clanked in the night. Wood groaned. Passing through it took a couple minutes. It was enough of a delay that Dante suspected there must be a secret bypass elsewhere for when the minister and his agents needed to travel in a hurry. Past it, big blocks of buildings sat on the flats, blotting out the night. A spiderweb of catwalks and ladders connected the flats, blurring the transition between one structure and the next. A speckling of stars peeped behind the leaves. The soldiers climbed out onto a branch, passed through a gated checkpoint, and led them down a narrow ledge along the back of one of the buildings. A single rope rail stood between Dante and a 400-foot drop. He was glad it was too dark to see the way down. The lead soldier unlocked a nondescript door, took them up a cramped staircase into a slightly less cramped hallway, knocked on a door, and said something Dante couldn't understand. A male voice replied from the other side. As feet thudded behind the door, the soldier turned to them and made a statement. Ast nodded and handed over his sword. Dante hesitated, then did the same. The door opened to a long rectangular room with a snapping fireplace, shelves of books and ledgers, and eight more soldiers standing around the walls in statuesque stillness. A great many rugs, weavings, curios, carvings, and artifacts filled the walls, floors, and tables. There were no aesthetic commonalities to the hoard of art, as if it had been collected from all across Wesley and lands beyond. Dante didn't have a lot of time to absorb this, however, as someone immediately began speaking to him in what sounded like a sub-dialect of third. The man wore simple black clothes and the unmistakable air of authority. He said something more, a question, judging by its inflection, and cocked his head at Dante. 2 seconds ticked by. Ast opened his mouth. The man, presumably the minister, made a cutting motion with his hand.
"Or should I put it another way?" he said, switching to Gascon.
He smiled brightly.
"I see you understand me now. That provides the answer to my question. Where are you from?"
"Gasc," Dante confirmed, breaking from their cover story.
"You might as well be telling me you're from Earth."
"Tatonin," he improvised. "We are exploring the possibility of bringing tea from Galador to Wesley."
"How exactly did you manage to cross the Wodans?"
"Ponies bred for mountains and cold weather. We had to use wall tents the whole way."
"Are these very small ponies?"
The minister smiled.
"Or did you bring very large tents?"
"I heard stories of Kappas," Dante tried. "We must have been fortunate. We encountered none along the way."
"You would be the first."
His jaw tightened.
"I believe you're lying, and that I will punish you by throwing you off the top of this tree."
"I was born in the Eastern Wodans," Ast said.
The minister paused mid-gesture to his guards and raised one brow. Ast continued, "But I've lived in Gask for many years. I know the ways. I took them through Torun Pass."
The minister narrowed his eyes.
"Have the Kappers granted you a gentleman's agreement to leave your bodies intact?"
"They've been drawn away from the divide by strange lights to the north."
"The ghost lights?"
Ast shook his head.
"Not like any I've ever seen. We've been trying to find a route through the mountains for a year. When I saw the Kappers vacating the route, I seized the opportunity to make the attempt."
The minister stroked his upper lip.
"Just the two of you?"
"We lost a couple in the crossing. There are others here with us."
"That matches what I had heard. And I thank you for telling the truth. Where are they now?"
"What is all this about?" Dante said.
"It's about the fact you're foreigners, Gascons, who are in my lands, my home, without my permission."
Dante gave Ast a severe look.
"I wasn't aware we had to register."
The minister laughed.
"You believe you should be granted clemency because you were too irresponsible to learn the laws of my land?"
"Your Highness, one of the reasons for our trip was to learn more about your people. In Gask, Wesley is virtually unknown."
He smirked.
"Perhaps we like it that way."
"I've reached a decision. You won't be flung from the farthest ledge. Instead, you will leave Spiron. Now. And you will never return."
"We're not done with our business."
"Yes," the minister said, "you are."
Their soldier escort flanked them. The minister nodded at the commander, then sprawled in a stuffed chair and grabbed a book from his desk. The troops took them back into the night.
"Where are your friends?" their captain said once they were below the palace.
Ast rattled off an address in third.
The captain gave a quick order.
Half the soldiers jogged toward the flat connected to the other tree. The descent to the ground took several minutes. There, the captain returned their swords. Dante had Ast tell the commander about the ponies, hoping to be allowed to fetch them himself, give the soldiers the slip, and rush to track down the monk. But the soldiers shadowed him to the stables, where a very angry owner woke to bring the ponies around and demand more money for the inconvenience. The captain said something, and the owner went quiet and sullen. Dante had been on edge this whole time. half expecting that once the soldiers rousted Somber, C, and Lou from the inn, they'd be imprisoned, or led to a quiet place to be slaughtered. But the other three were brought to them without incident. As they took to the road, the minister's soldiers continued to chaperone them. "What's happening?" C said.
"We saw the minister," Dante said. "He suggested we leave, or he would be happy to throw us out. Of the tree."
"The minister? How did he know we were here?"
Dante glanced back over his shoulder at the soldiers. "Keep walking."
It was already 1 in the morning, but the soldiers stayed with them until they stopped 2 hours later at a 1 Lauren village with rooms available in the roots. The captain walked up to Dante.
"We'll check with the innkeep tomorrow to make sure you've moved on. I suggest you don't tarry."
Given the lateness of the hour and the exhaustion soaking Dante's body, it was a minor miracle he didn't explode the captain's head on the spot.
"My tarrying will be kept to the bare minimum."
He watched the men walk away. No stable was open this late, so Dante revised the plan, taking the ponies beneath the roots of a different tree. Their group settled in, hanging up tarps and unrolling blankets.
"I don't know how the minister knew about us," Dante said, finally answering C's question,
"given how particular he is about allowing outsiders into his realm. Anyone in Kor could have turned us in."
"Well, now what?" Lou said. "They threw us out before we got to talk to the monk."
Dante nodded. He was having a hard time thinking of anything besides passing out.
"We'll have to move along for at least another day, make sure the locals see us leaving, then turn around and sneak back into Kor."
"How are we going to do that? There are toll bridges between every loft, guards everywhere.
Some of the flats are connected to other trees. We may be able to sneak up to one of the unpopulated Laurens and cross over to the one where we were staying, or hire a local to take a message to the monk to meet us on the ground."
"As far as we know," Somber said, "the monk was the one who turned us in."
"It wasn't," C said, "and we don't need to go back to Kor."
Dante rubbed his bleary eyes.
"Is that right? Did you suddenly remember what Selen is, and where we left it?"
"Can't help you there, but I did see a very scared-looking monk fleeing from the soldiers taking you into custody. It occurred to me we might not get another chance to speak to him, so I stopped him."
She produced a tiny scroll.
"He gave me this."
Dante grabbed at it, but it was written in third, and the few words he understood made no sense. He handed it to Ast.
Ast unrolled the scroll in his palm and scowled at it, as if it had told him his mother enjoyed the company of men who weren't his father.
"It's an address."
"Do you recognize it? Is it close?"
"It's one of the biggest cities in Wesley, and it's 300 miles from here."
"What's the address to? Another shrine?"
Ast handed him the scroll.
"Beats the hell out of me."
Dante burgeoned with curiosity, but he had an even greater need for rest. Despite the damp, the chill, and the snorts of the ponies, he managed to sleep until mid-morning. Before they struck out, he dropped by the inn to let the owners see they were on their way out of Spiron. And then they walked. Then and there, with the immediate need to put Spiron behind them, they had no choice but to continue on foot. After discussing the situation, however, they reached the consensus that they would walk to their new destination. For one thing, they might have enough silver to buy 5+ horses, but they didn't have enough in Spirish currency. For another, even if they wanted to risk dawdling around in a land they'd been banished from, the woods weren't exactly teeming with horses, or 4-legged beasts of burden and or meat of any kind. Dante and the crew ran into the occasional flock of sheep or herd of goats, but for the most part, the people found it more fruitful to harvest their trees than to plow fields or maintain herds. The few horses stabled in the Laurens were property of the wealthy, or those whose livelihoods relied on fast travel. So, with the option of revisiting the issue once they crossed into less hostile lands, they made their way forward on foot. The road was well drained, and they made fine time. The forest continued around them, the rolling hills falling lower with each mile.
"Was this what you had in mind when you came to Narashtovik?" Dante said to C, as the afternoon grew late.
"When I signed up to be your hunter," she said. "No. I figured I'd spend all day down in a basement signing papers."
"You can't be that blasé.
2 months ago we hardly knew this place existed."
She gazed up at the trees.
"I didn't even know Wesley's name."
"How did you get into a job like this in the first place?"
"Growing up, I spent a lot of time hiding. Once I got older, I found I developed a keen insight for where other miserable creatures might try to hide."
He watched her sidelong.
"Often."
She laughed through her nose.
"Sooner or later, aren't we all?"
"Do you think I'm prying? We've been working together for a season, and I hardly know a thing about you."
"I was born in Setevan," she said. "Mother died in childbirth. Father died of plague when I was 7. A family friend took me in, but he was killed in a duel less than a year later. Despite winning, the aggrieved party did not feel the death of my foster father was satisfaction enough. He came for the rest of us. With the estate crumbling and my foster brothers being hunted, I wound up in the streets."
"I was on the streets of Brussels for a while," Dante said, "but not until I was 16.
C was quiet for a moment.
"Well, I was 8. And a girl. And my adopted name was a death warrant, signed by one of the palace's bluest bloods, and its most bloodthirsty."
"Sounds like Cassander," he said. She nodded.
"Wait. It was? I killed him. In the war."
"I know," C said. "Why do you think I wanted to help you find your friend?"
"The pocket-splitting reward.
I should feel ashamed for not wanting to starve to death."
"How did you get through it the first time? Alone, hunted by a powerful man when you were so young?"
"At first I followed dogs."
She laughed. "I figured they'd know their way around.
Then I fell in with kids like myself. We stole food, picked pockets. When we got low, our leader rented us out as servants for days or weeks at a time. She got the money, and we got slices of bread. I was better off with the dogs."
"Did you have to kill her?"
Lou said, hushed.
C laughed harder than before.
"Is murder your solution to everything?"
"I ran away.
She probably thought I'd died. No one cared either way."
"There are always more like me. Kids with so little they're grateful for anything. You work yourself to the bone for your daily bread. You wake up tomorrow and do it again. Better than sleeping on the street.
Than never knowing where your next meal will come from.
Of course, when you work like that, you're running in place, and if you ever fall down, you won't have the strength to pick yourself back up."
"That's what I figured, anyway. For a while after I ran away, I lived mean, thieving. For a while I lurked under the docks and ate the fruit and grain that fell from the boats. Then I started to live smart. I found a notch in the ridges overlooking the palace and grew a secret garden. One day I left my garden and walked down the Street of Kings. A servant's horse had stumbled, broken a leg. The servant needed to see it, but he needed to deliver a letter immediately. For some reason, I still don't know why, he thought he could trust me. Maybe he saw a young girl, reasonably clean, and thought I'd do whatever I was told. He was wrong about that, but right that he could trust me. Because I saw an opportunity. After years in the streets, I knew the city like I'd built it. I delivered his message faster than he'd have brought it on horseback. He was so grateful he kept bringing me more and more jobs. I was quicker than the devil and never got robbed. Servants talk. Word spread. Soon I had more work than I could handle. Eventually, hired a couple other girls to keep up with it. After a few years, I got bored, traveled, quit being a courier, and started being a hunter. And I always worked for myself. That's the only way.
Dante looked up. Then why are you so eager to work for me?
She pulled down her hood. They'd entered a clearing and the sun was out. When Cassander killed my foster dad and got away without so much as a slap on the wrist, it taught me that we might all live in the same city, but men like him walk in a higher world. Untouchable. If a person up there reaches down to kill a person like me, no one's going to stop them.
Unless you attach yourself to someone else from that world.
C nodded. It grinds my teeth, but that's how it is. Figured I may as well attach myself to the person who got to Cassander before I could.
That's a hell of a story, Dante said. Why didn't you tell me sooner?
I didn't want your decision to be colored by sympathy. I wanted you to hire me because I'm the best.
She left it at that. When dusk fell, they holed up beneath a juvenile lorren whose roots were barely spacious enough to accommodate the ponies. Ast swung up into the branches to cut down laurels. Lou scurried around beneath him, trying to catch the fruits before they dashed into the dirt. 3 days after their departure from Korl, the forest came to an end. The hills overlooked a long plain. The horizon was crumpled with another range of hills. Patches of the basin were dark green with trees, but these were common firs, nothing like the land they'd just left. Instead, the pastoral scene was much like any in Gask or Malin. Flocks of sheep, small villages, a keep standing watch on a lonely hill. They stopped at a village to sleep in real beds and allow Ast the opportunity to get directions to the city of Ellen. The locals spoke the same language as the people of Spiron, but with an accent that sharpened their vowels into lethal points. When Ast asked the way to Ellen, they looked at him like he'd asked which direction was up. Dante seized the opportunity to work on his Wesleyan and to learn more about the city the monk in Korl had sent them to for answers. Ellen was the capital of the plains region known as Cameron, and its history had echoes of Narashtivik, repeatedly sacked, wrecked, and burned, sometimes to the point where its citizens had considered abandoning it altogether. One woman, who had lived there for many years before retiring to the countryside to farm, proved a bountiful source of information. It sounded like the foundation of Ellen's current prosperity had been laid roughly 2 centuries ago, when a fiendish series of marriages, trade agreements, and border realignments had converted 2 enemies into allies, pacified 3 others, and reduced 1 foe to ashes. Ellen had experienced ups and downs since then. It sat in the middle of the prairie and had few natural defenses, but kept itself intact through aggressive trade and politicking. She had no insight into the address they'd been given, and nothing she said stood out as an obvious reason why Ellen would hold the keys to understanding Selen. But with a city that big and that busy, Dante could believe it possessed the wisdom they needed to finally take another step toward their goal. Overnight, a snowstorm blew in, layering the plains with 3 inches of white. To save wear on themselves and their ponies, they stopped for a night in a middling burg. In the plaza, a vendor of beef pasties looked askance at their Spirish currency. An eavesdropping merchant offered to swap it, for a minimal fee, for Camrish money, which looked much closer to what Dante was used to, round metal coins, though these had holes punched through the middle. In the smallest denominations, the coins were thin rings. As they increased in value, the holes shrank until they were so small you could hardly pass a string through them. Dante recognized bronze and silver, but was confused by the most valuable, which resembled tin. Ast informed him it was aluminum. They crossed the hills and looked down on a sweep of grassland dotted with lakes and carved up by sluggish streams. Herds of sheep and cows roamed the prairie, cropping the grass that tufted the snow. Many of the beasts were tended to, but others appeared to be wild. After inquiring at another village, Ast hooked south at a crossroads. This connected to a larger, rutted road running eastward, parallel to a wide, languid river. People came and went in both directions. Many of the wagons were laden with lumber, harvested along the river or in Spiren. All of it was bound toward Ellen. For the last 2 days of their walk, they fell in with one such caravan. Dante thought they'd be less conspicuous arriving in the company of legitimate businessmen. With the plains so flat, Ellen was visible from 30 miles away. At first it was just a dark lump beneath a pall of smoke, but it soon congealed into a typical, if gigantic, city. Makeshift slums around its outer walls. Row houses were visible behind the walls, interrupted by cathedrals, universities, palaces, and a towering colosseum. Most of the larger structures were made from clay bricks or sandstone, but the housing was a mishmash of that and wood. Whatever the materials used, the architecture remained uniform. The homes were squared off with flat roofs. The more elaborate structures employed square or hexagonal towers, frequently with domed caps. While they were still a mile outside it, horns piped from within the walls, blasting from several points across the city. Dante started. The lumber merchants took no notice.
"Ah," Dante recovered. "Sounds like they're heralding our arrival."
Lou wrinkled his brow.
"How would they know?"
C laughed. "Question is, are they horns of celebration or warning?" The front gates were a grill of shining brass bars. The city walls were fired brick. Their group was met by guards wearing white and carrying long spears. After a cursory investigation, the guards allowed them into what turned out to be a brief maze. The caravan navigated it easily, emerging through another gate into the city proper. A brick tower faced them across a plaza of pale yellow flagstones. People streamed in and out of the gate and the buildings, ringing the square. Ast had already asked the caravan's members for directions to the note's address, and after exchanging goodbyes, the two groups parted ways. Ast led their party down a side street that linked up with a wide but less frantic avenue. People babbled to all sides. Much of it was in third, but a good bit was in tongues Dante didn't understand, including at least 3 others that sounded like they might be branches of the greater Wesleyan speech tree. After several blocks, the street spilled into a sprawling fruit and vegetable market. Much of the trade was in grain, rice, spices and other dry goods, but there were also fresh laurels and mounds of citrus in greens, yellows, oranges and pinks. Most had brown spots on their skins, but they looked edible enough. Ast bought a handful of limes and spoke with a vendor who explained how to navigate their new environment. Ellen was enormous, and as hodgepodge as all great cities were, yet its main streets were laid out in a vast grid, individually named. Every building was marked by a chest-high stone pillar, marked with a numeral and a cardinal direction to tell you which side of the street it was on. They were looking for Iden Street, number 327 East. According to Ast, they were already on the proper street, and now it was a simple matter of following it to the correct address. The brick shop to Dante's right said, number 151 East. The next one up was number 152 East. They continued north. Very quickly, he became myopic to anything but the increase of the numbers. These ticked along in orderly fashion, but now and then one got skipped. He could only guess the address had been absorbed by a neighboring building, or possibly got destroyed long ago in one of Ellen's many raids and wars. Over the next half mile, several addresses were skipped, missing. And yet, when they reached number 326, and the neighboring building advanced to number 328, Dante was dumbstruck. Number 326 was a private residence. Number 328 was a shop filled with bolts of cotton, silk, and hemp. Ast inquired with the avuncular shopkeeper, who got a puzzled look, and informed them there was no number 327 East on Iden Street. Dante had asked to check in at two other businesses across the street, then with three separate street vendors. All agreed there was no such address. They returned to the textile shop and paid off the owner for a thorough inspection upstairs and down. The roof allowed them a good look at the neighboring residence. There was no sign of a hidden address anywhere. Baffled to the core, Dante wandered to the shadow of a sandstone temple. "Why would the monk send us to a place that doesn't exist?" Ast shook his head. "Cities change. Perhaps he hasn't been here in a long time." "Maybe," C said. "Or maybe he meant to send us on a two-tailed fox chase." "Then why all this subterfuge?" Dante said. "Why go to the bother of setting up a midnight meeting that could have landed him in deep shit with the minister? He could have told us any old lie, and we'd have bought it." Lou folded his arms. "Could he have written it down wrong? What if it's actually at 372 East or something?" This sounded plausible, barely, but Dante was worn out, thirsty, angry, and tired of wrangling the ponies around the crowded streets. Running down the various ways the monk might have transposed the numbers would take hours. He decided to find a stable and an inn and clear his head. Ast got directions to a place two blocks away. Unlike the monk's address, this inn actually existed. The innkeeper quoted them a nightly price. Ast frowned. Dante had little reference for the cost of things in Ellen, yet the man's price struck him as ludicrous. The man grinned and countered with an offer 5% lower. Dante was good and pissed off, and the ensuing bartering session gave him the opportunity to blow off a great deal of steam. When he made his final offer, the innkeeper laughed, slapped his hand, and offered him two pitchers of free beer. Dante accepted with a smile, feeling an instant camaraderie with the man. It struck him that Ellen's intense focus on commerce might have arisen as a survival strategy. With Ast's assistance, he plumbed the innkeep for knowledge of the city. The man had lived in Ellen all his life, but couldn't remember there ever being a building on Iden Street designated number 327 East.
"What exactly are you trying to find?" he said. A delicate question, but Dante had already given it thought.
"Do you have the Celicet here? The River of Stars?" The innkeeper pursed his lips.
"This is a place?"
"It's the House of the 12 Gods. Their seats in the sky."
13, the man corrected. "The 13 lords of the Broken Circle."
Dante needed a bit of help from Ast to translate that, and then to ask and confirm that the 13 lords were the Wesleyan equivalent of Aron, Tame, Leah, and so on.
"Are you a priest?" the innkeeper said.
Dante nodded. "I'm from Malin. In my travels I discovered that while the land of Gask shares many of our beliefs, Gascon accounts of the past differ from ours. After years of inconclusive research, I've come to Wesley to see if your stories can help guide me to the truth."
"You've come to the right place. Ellen is famed around the world for its scholarship."
Dante felt no compunction to let the man know that in Malin and Gask, Ellen wasn't famed to exist, let alone be a hotbed of learning.
"Where would I go to learn more?"
The man immediately rattled off half a dozen of what, judging by the fact Dante couldn't understand any of them, he assumed were proper names.
"But the first place I'd go is the Stole of the Winds. They're proud of their wisdom, and eager to exchange it with others."
Dante asked for and asked transcribed the very thorough directions that followed. The innkeep lingered a moment to ensure there was nothing more, then went to slap hands and exchange loud greetings with another patron. "I don't know why the monk sent us here," Dante said. "Maybe we're being misled, or maybe we haven't searched hard enough yet. By the way, Ellen is big, and we can move openly. I think we can find knowledge of our past here."
"You're the boss," Sombo said dryly. "Perhaps we could divide our labor to hasten the search."
"I need ask to translate."
Sombo shrugged.
"I speak well enough to get around on my own."
"Can I go with you to the stall?" Lou said. "It sounds fascinating."
C flicked the rim of her beer cup.
"That's not in the top 1,000 words I'd use to describe it."
"Because you don't have 1,000 words in your vocabulary."
She stared him down, then laughed and waved her hand.
"Enjoy your temple. I'm going with Sombo."
"Fine," Dante said. "Sombo, if anything happens, you know how to reach me."
That got strange looks from Ast and C, a brief nod from Sombo, and a look of smug wisdom from Lou. Dante wasn't tempted to explain. The loons were still a highly guarded secret. Now that he thought about it, he wasn't certain they'd work. He and Sombo didn't have a direct connection. Rather, they had to pass messages back and forth through Nak, who was hundreds of miles away, in Narashtovik. Since the loons were bound by shared nether, they could, theoretically, work from any distance, but Dante had never tested them at this range, nor when there was a colossal mountain range separating his loon from its twin. As soon as Somber and C were on their way, Dante went to the back of the inn on the pretext of using the water closet. Once he was alone in the dim, cool hallway, he activated his loon and pulsed Nak.
"My goodness," Nak said. "Do I even want to ask where you are right now?"
Dante chuckled.
"The city of Ellen, capital of Cameron, one of the superlative territories of the Amalgamated Kingdom of Wesley."
"Is there anything more boring than the name of a place you'll never visit?"
"The appendices of the cycle."
Hearing a footstep, Dante glanced behind him, but the hallway was empty.
"Let Ollivander know that progress is slow, but I remain optimistic we'll land our fish."
"Are we speaking in code now? The raven watches the plane."
"Glad it's found employment. Will you loon Somber and confirm we're capable of exchanging messages? We just split up."
Nak allowed that he would do so and dropped the link. A moment later, Dante's loon pulsed. Nak had successfully made contact with Somber.
"By the way," Nak said, "there was another burst of lights in the Wodens a couple weeks ago. And your friend from the mountains, Vincent, he says a party of strangers passed through Saul not long after you did. They claimed they were pilgrims from Yalin, but Vincent got a look inside one of their pouches and saw a letter sealed with Mulligan's wax."
Dante dropped his voice to a whisper.
"The king knows about Selen?"
"Given the accepted definition of the word no, we don't know about Selen. Thus I doubt Modigan knows what he's after, but we can assume he knows there might be something worth aftering for."
"Good thing we sent our finest spy to another country. What would you like me to do about this?"
"Ollivander's monitoring the situation," Nak said,
"unworried as ever. Just thought you'd like to know."
Dante shut off the loon. Back in the common room, he gathered up Ast and Lou and hit the streets. Sunlight dazzled from the jaundiced bricks. A pleasant wind blew through town. It had to be nearly 50 degrees out, easily the warmest it had been since they'd crossed the Wodens. He couldn't say if the profusion of people in the streets was a product of the weather, or if it was always this busy in Ellen. Many of the residents wore drooping white cotton that resembled a fitted version of a monk's robes. They wore scarves around their heads or mouths, bright with the colors of flame—red, orange, yellow. There were a great deal of foreigners, too, including a healthy minority of Spirish dressed in their loose, earth-toned garb with cinched ankles and wrists. Maybe it was the steady wind, or the open prairie on all sides, but it didn't smell as bad as most cities. Some animal dung, but that was largely overwhelmed by the profusion of vegetables, perfumes, and spices on display on every block, along with the racks of meat, onions, and garlic being grilled in every plaza. He'd never seen a more grill-happy place. He would have to find time to take advantage of it. They had an address for the Stole of the Winds, but hardly needed it. Dozens of orange banners fluttered from the rim of its round roof. It stood 100 feet high, its outer layer faced with a vertical brick herringbone pattern, dizzying to look at. Each floor was separated by solid blocks of sandstone carved with friezes. The front doors stood open. Inside, the vestibule was lit by narrow windows, redolent of incense. Ast informed a passing monk they were foreigners seeking the wisdom of the Lords of the Broken Circle. Could he help them? The monk smiled and padded into the depths of the stall. As a convert to the path of Aron, which would get him beaten or hanged in his homeland, Dante felt vaguely uncomfortable strolling into an alien church to chew the fat with its priests. But the man who strolled out to meet them was all smiles. He wore airy cotton robes, and his head was shaved. His lack of hair, his tan, and the crinkles around his smiling eyes made it difficult to gauge his age. But he had to be close to 60. He introduced himself as Mickle, and took them up 2 flights to a small room with a balcony overlooking the street. Dante explained what he told the innkeeper. Sometimes he needed asked to clarify certain words or concepts, but he was finding himself more and more comfortable with the Wesleyan language. When he finished, the priest chuckled like a purring cat. "If Gask's stories are different than Malan's, and Wesley's stories are different from Gask's, how will you be any closer to the truth? Won't you just be more confused?" "That depends on how much sense your stories make," Dante said. The man laughed some more. "If they made sense, why would the world need people like me to interpret them?" Dante smiled. "Perhaps because the truths are so simple, people distrust them." The priest glanced about, as if for eavesdroppers, and leaned forward. "Personally, I think we contort the words of the gods to ensure we stay in business. Don't tell." He found it impossible not to like the bald old man. "I understand your people believe in something called the 13 Lords of the Broken Circle. This raises 2 questions.
Both would be answered by the Cycle of Geron."
Dante checked with Ast to make sure he understood. "The Cycle of Geron?"
"Indeed. To a man of your background, it is exactly as blasphemous as it sounds."
"You know the Cycle of Aron? How?"
Mickle leaned forward and pressed his palms together.
"Because, depending on your point of view, our book corrects it. Or perverts it."
All of this was so interesting, Dante temporarily set aside all concerns of Selen.
"So you've read both?"
The priest nodded.
"Unlike most people with an opinion on the matter, which means I disagree that Geron is either a correction or a perversion, that would present Aron as the first text, an authority Geron is responding to. But Geron doesn't merely pick up where Aron leaves off. Instead, they diverge from a common trunk, 2 forks of the same tree, not father and offspring, but siblings."
"How long ago do the 2 accounts diverge?"
"Not as easy to determine as you might expect."
"Because the cycle, of Aron, I mean, isn't chronological.
Nor is Geron. And certain older elements of Aron were decanonized for Geron, while other passages that weren't included in yours were made canon in ours.
This makes the divergence among the most hotly debated fields of study.
Mickle eyed him. Conservatives generally agree one book became two about 400 years ago. Credible written accounts stretch back that far. More radical scholars, however, placed the date a millennium in the past, or further.
Dante needed quite a lot of help from Ass to work through all this. Once he understood, he gave Mickle a quizzical look.
I must say, for a priest, you discuss this very openly.
The man shrugged, white cotton robe shifting on his shoulders.
It's not like this everywhere in Wesley. If your journeys take you elsewhere, remember your version of the truth is heresy.
Naturally. As for myself, I consider our truth strong enough to withstand interrogation. Furthermore, given the confusing history of our holiest book, isn't it our duty to explore its past? If we don't know where it came from, how can we hope to understand it?
Do you have a spare copy of Geron? Dante said.
Many. We prefer them not to leave the stole, but if you'd like to take one, we only require that you make a donation to cover the costs of transcription.
I don't suppose you have one in Gascon, or Malish.
We may have a translation, but it would take time to copy. Would you like a Wesleyan version in the meantime?
Very much, Dante said. Can you tell me about the schism?
Can't wait to read it for yourself.
Mickle laughed.
He glanced out the window at the sky.
I can give you the condensed version.
Many, many years ago, two tribes occupied the land, the Rashan and the Elson. These two were similar enough that some believe they were once the same, a belief I share, though now is not the time to explore why. Both were devoutly loyal to Aron, so much so that they became rivals for his favor. They offered him feasts, sacrifices, named holidays in his honor. Yet no matter how hard they tried, he gave them no sign which tribe he held in greater esteem. In time, they began to fight, thinking this would prove who he loved more. At first, this took the form of champions in single combat, but as more warriors died and Aron stayed silent, the tribe's rivalry descended into hatred. Soon, they were at war. Within a generation, both tribes stood on the brink of the end. Before they could destroy themselves completely, Aron finally made himself known. Because the Elson had struck last, and, I believe, to terrorize the people into never fighting such a war again, he ruined them utterly. Floods, fires, quakes. In his wrath, the storms lasted for years, erasing all sight of the Elson. Yet they persisted, because Aron's daughter, Geron, believed he was wrong to eradicate those who loved him. With the circle of heaven's promise broken, she led the Elson in secret to another land, east of the Wodens. And while the people knew better than ever of Aron's true might, they had also learned better than to worship strength. Now they honored wisdom, and Geron was its brightest light.
Mickle fell silent. While Dante was able to follow most of this, he'd required Ast's help with the more obscure words, and so the telling of the story had taken longer than it might have. As Dante began his first question, brass horns blared from the top of the stole of the winds, echoed by others across the city.
"Duty calls," Mickle said. "Please see me again once you've had time to absorb our book for yourself. In the meantime, I will see if we have a translation in one of your native tongues."
He smiled, rose, and bowed. Dante returned the gesture. A monk waited just outside the door. He led Dante, Ast, and a dazed Lou downstairs,
and presented Dante with a copy of The Cycle of Geron. Its cover was blue, and bore an icon of a white circle broken by a wedge of nothing. The monk showed them outside. Dante stopped on the steps. The streets were packed with people, but none of them seemed in a hurry. In fact, they were all seated or in the process of sitting down, talking, laughing, passing small plates of food back and forth. Part of him wanted to find out what was going on, but a much hungrier part wanted to return to the inn and read. He headed down the steps and toward the inn, keeping close to the buildings. They drew many looks, some curious, a few hostile.
"These people are mad," Lou whispered.
"They look peaceful enough to me," Dante said.
"Not them,"
Lou gestured back at the stole.
"Them.
For thinking something differently than we do." "Then everyone outside Gask is a raving lunatic, as are many Gaskins. To be on the safe side, you'd better not leave Narashtovik.
Hell, you'd probably better never leave your room."
"Don't tell me you believe what he said."
"Did you hear what was at the heart of Mikkel's story?" Dante stepped around a blanket, held down by a dozen gabbing people. "Aron doesn't need our uninterrupted praise. He keeps himself at a remove, where he has the best perspective to judge. We'd be wise to look to him for inspiration."
As they walked, several groups invited them to sit down and share their meal, but Dante feigned an inability to understand, shaking his head and smiling blandly. He and the others were still wearing their spirish garb, and this seemed to exempt them from whatever mass ritual was taking place. They got to the inn. Out front, the innkeeper waved to them, seated among a gaggle of people whose dress marked them as being from all corners of the land. Dante almost walked past, but the innkeeper got up and stood in his path, gesturing to their blanket.
"What's happening?" Dante said. "Is this a holiday?"
The man cocked his head.
"It's sit. Now sit."
It seemed important, and it was never a bad idea to get on the good side of the one providing your food and bed, so he sat on the blanket and was treated to rice-stuffed grape leaves, apricot tarts, and a thorough explanation of sit, a twice-daily ritual where the entire city dropped whatever it was doing to encamp in the streets, share a snack, and catch up with each other. This struck Dante as a big waste of time, but the locals spoke of the people who didn't follow the custom with the same air of disapproval you'd use to discuss someone who made a habit of going to the market without wearing pants. Half an hour after the afternoon sit began, and mere minutes after Dante had joined it, a blue flag was hoisted from the stole down the street. People stood, dusted themselves off, waved goodbye, and picked their business up where it had left off. Dante climbed up to his room and threw himself into his new book. Though he found it much simpler to read a foreign language than to speak it, speech was a mangled mush, but reading let you concentrate on each word. The diction of The Cycle of Geron didn't exactly match the colloquial speech of modern Wesleyans. Even Ast struggled with it. They hadn't gotten far by the time Somber and C returned from the street.
"Any progress?" C said.
Dante marked his place and held up the book. "They use a different cycle. It diverged from ours a long time back. I'm hoping its history includes mention of Selen. Once I'm a little better versed with it, I'll go back to speak to the priest again."
"I see. Got a minute to try something else?"
It could take days of reading before he felt well versed enough in Geron to go back to Mikkel. To Dante, that just meant he had less time to spare. The thought of sacrificing any of it curdled him with annoyance.
"Is this something Somber could take care of?" he said.
"You're better at it," Somber said. "If this is as delicate as I think it is, I'd rather not compromise our chances of success."
That was cryptic and paranoid, but then again, it was Somber. Dante set down the book.
Success at what?
Here. C handed him a rat. It was dead, though not obviously so. Follow me.
He slung his cloak over his shoulders and followed